From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Advocates for people with disabilities are fighting hard against proposed changes to the Americans with Disabilities Act. The proposal, called the ADA Education and Reform Act, recently passed the House, and it would make it harder for people to sue businesses that do not comply with the ADA. That's the landmark 1990 law that requires businesses and other public places to accommodate those with disabilities. Now, this new bill would prevent lawsuits against non-ADA compliant businesses for 6 months, and instead, owners would receive a written notice and time, again, that six-month period, to do something about the complaint. Jennifer Mathis is Director of Policy and Legal Advocacy for the Bazelon Center for Mental Health Law. They're opposed to this bill. Jennifer, welcome. And let me just first ask you, what is your core concern here? What concern do you have with the changes being proposed?
So the bill that passed the House would really fundamentally change the way the ADA works. And I think most concerning, it would take away any incentive for businesses to comply with the ADA and specifically with its public accommodations provisions. So if a business doesn't comply with the ADA and they exclude people with disabilities, could be for months, could be for years, we'd be sending the message, that's fine with us. We think it's too much of a burden on you to understand what your obligations are to people with disabilities. And so we're going to wait, and you can wait and see if a person with a disability who is harmed, who is excluded, then sends you a complicated written legal notice explaining to you what your obligations are and telling you the circumstances under which they were excluded. Until then, there's no consequence for not complying.
So just to be clear, right, so as you're saying, the proposal is instead of the threat of immediate legal action, there would be this six-month period allowed for businesses to make improvements and this written notice of non-compliance before legal action could be sought. So proponents of these changes say that they're not taking lawsuits off the table as motivation. They're just giving businesses a chance of, in their eyes, a more fair chance to become compliant.
Right. And I think there's two problems with that. I mean, one is this law has been on the books for 28 years, right? So we're also saying you don't even need to start thinking about how you make yourself accessible until somebody gets harmed, is excluded, and sends you this complicated notice. That means that before that, there might be dozens and dozens of people with disabilities that come to your business, see the step, realize they can't get in their wheelchair, and go away. So what we're doing is saying it doesn't matter, you know, that you're not complying with the law. It's not your responsibility.
Mm. Well, you know, for example, Republican Ted Poe, who brought the bill to the House, has essentially said that he believes these changes could improve the ADA by giving, you know, businesses these notices on what problems they have so that they can fix it rather than, you know, having to be prepared to fight costly lawsuits, that their efforts would be focused in the right places and not in the courtrooms.
Right. It tells you something that every single disability group, hundreds and hundreds of disability groups have signed these letters opposing this bill. If it supposedly helps people with disabilities, I think you'd see support from people with disabilities. They don't believe that, and it's because it's not true.
Mm. Yeah, in fact, activists are so concerned about it that some interrupted a House Rules Committee meeting last week in which lawmakers were considering the bill. What's your response to kind of one of the basic critiques that some congressmen and women who are sponsoring this bill, that they have about the ADA, that it's left businesses vulnerable to, quote, drive-by lawsuits?
Sure. So there are, as there are with any other law, some lawyers who have engaged in fraud or unethical practices. And that's actually a very, very small number of lawyers, but they've engaged in these extortionist demand letters where they'll send a demand letter saying, hey, you're violating the ADA, send me money and I'll go away. Incidentally, it's important to point out that the ADA itself, this part of the ADA, provides no money damages. So most of those people that are filing a lot of lawsuits, they're also filing with state law claims. And it's the state laws, not the ADA, that have the damages in them. And so changing the ADA is not going to change that. But in any event, the courts around the country have used the ordinary mechanisms to shut those kinds of activities down. And there are lawyers who are in prison. There are lawyers who have been disbarred. There are lawyers who are suspended. There are lawyers who have paid hefty fees. We have the ordinary means to deal with that kind of conduct, and we don't need to take away people's civil rights in order to fix fraud. So I think that it's going to be a different story in the Senate. Now that people with disabilities are fired up about this, I think their senators will hear from them, and the Senate, I think, is not going to pass something like this.
Hmm. Well, Jennifer Mathis is Director of Policy and Legal Advocacy for the Bazelon Center for Mental Health Law. Thank you so much.
Sure.
President Donald Trump is spending President's Day at his private golf club in West Palm Beach. Meanwhile, the White House said today that the president supports efforts to improve the federal gun background check system. A bipartisan Senate bill received some renewed attention after last week's school shooting in Parkland, Florida, that left 17 people dead. Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said the president has spoken with Senator John Cornyn. He's the Texas Republican about this bill, and it's designed to strengthen the FBI database of prohibited gun buyers. So let's bring in Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. He joins us from Princeton studios. Julian, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
You know, we've heard so many powerful statements from students who survived the shooting in Florida. I mean, have we reached some kind of tipping point on the issue of guns and gun control?
Well, many people hope so, but at this point, we can't assume that's going to happen. We've had many shootings over the decades with horrific stories like this and horrific images coming out of schools and office buildings, and there's often an outcry like this. But in the end, the power of the NRA is quite formidable on Capitol Hill, and we've seen members of both parties back away from substantive reform. So if we're just betting, I think we still have to be very skeptical that change is going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, the bill that we're referring to is basically the same legislation that was introduced last year after that terrible church shooting in Texas. You know, nothing really changed then. Nothing changed after Sandy Hook. Nothing seems to have changed after Las Vegas. I mean, that was more than 500 people getting shot. So, but, you know, on the other hand, though, there are moments where presidents can emerge as genuine uniters, as leaders through what seem to be intractable problems. I mean, is this a potential moment like that for President Trump?
Well, it could be. I don't think it will be because of President Trump, at least until this point. He's not been very supportive of restrictions on gun purchases. He's actually moved in the other direction. Today's the first indication he's even open to this. And the president's own credibility is not so great that when you hear a statement like this, you can count on him following through. I think the only potential solution, the only potential hope would come from the grassroots. It would be if these students can turn their outrage into something larger that puts pressure on members of Congress to listen to someone other than gun rights advocates. And I think that's really the question we need to look at in the coming months.
You know, Twitter is not the best place for political analysis. I'll grant you that. But I was seeing some knowledgeable folks over the weekend saying the fact that the current feeling of outrage is student-led, you know, by these young people from the high school, it did harken back to them, to, you know, student-led activism in the civil rights movement. Is that even a fair comparison?
Sure. And student activism in the civil rights movement was incredibly effective in breaking through what at the time was seen as something that was impossible, obtaining civil rights legislation. Everything was stacked against it. And so there is something to that. But of course, this was one rally that we've seen so far and statements. It has to turn into something much more grandiose if it's going to look like what we saw in 1963 and 64. That involves students taking to the streets, mobilizing, organizing over the course of several years. And that's what this will require as well, because the obstacles are also quite formidable.
Yeah, I mean, formidable to the point where even presidents who supported more gun regulations failed, right? I mean, President Obama didn't get very far.
That's right. There's a few examples of success. President Clinton was able to get a federal ban on assault weapons.
Which then expired, right?
It expired 10 years later. There's not many examples of that, and it requires a huge investment of political capital by the president.
Yeah. Well, Julian, while we have you, just one last quick question separately about another thing regarding President Trump. What do you make of his reaction to the indictments unveiled on Friday that charged Russians with meddling in the 2016 election? We just got 30 seconds.
Well, he's angry, he's defensive, and I think it shows that this is front and center on his mind. And his response is what it's been throughout: attack, try to discredit, and otherwise ignore the facts in front of him.
Well, Julian Zelizer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's also the editor of the upcoming book, The Presidency of Barack Obama, which will be published next month. Julian, thank you as always.
Thanks for having me.
Let's check in on the Winter Olympics. Today was a very good day for the U.S. women's hockey team. They dismantled Finland with a 5-0 shutout to advance to the gold medal game. NPR's Russell Lewis joins us from Pyeongchang. And Russell, first of all, this U.S.-Finland game, it was a rout, but that doesn't even really begin to describe it. So tell us more about the game.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the U.S. really came in, you know, on a mission. I mean, really, since this tournament began, the whole point of what they've been angling for is to get back to the gold medal game. And they proved it against Finland today that this is something that they just wanted to do. They scored 2 goals right off the bat, and then within a minute scored 2 more goals, and that was it. You know, then it's 4-0, and then they could just sort of coast. And, you know, the U.S., you know, was saying that they weren't really looking ahead to the gold medal game, but in reality they were really planning to do that, and that's what they've done, is they've gone back to the gold medal game, and they've got a familiar opponent that they'll be playing.
Canada, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's not a surprise that these two teams are going to be playing each other. Canada is the dominant number one. They have won the last 4 gold medals at these Olympics. You know, and we should say that, you know, the United States has medaled in every Olympics since they added women's hockey back in 1998. They won gold in 98. So, you know, here they are again, both the U.S. and Canada getting ready to square off, and it should be, you know, one great game coming up.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really looking forward to it because 2 fantastic teams on the ice there. Let's switch now, if we can, to alpine skiing, because the weather has been a major problem for skiers. I mean, what's going on?
Yeah, you know, so the weather was really bad the first week. It was particularly cold, but it was also very, very windy. And, you know, here we are again learning that, you know, one of the key events is been moved up from Friday to Thursday, which, you know, affects American skier Michaela Schifrin. You know, she pulled out of the downhill, which is going to be raced on Wednesday, so that she can just focus on the alpine combined, which is now moved up from Friday to now Thursday. So, you know, these weather delays are really sort of creating all sorts of havoc, you know, both for organizers, but then also for the skiers, you know, having to sort of figure out which discipline do they want to try to go at, because it is difficult to sort of ski, you know, on back-to-back days, you know, at this level.
Now, one last thing, Russell, if I can, because Russian athletes are competing in these games under an Olympic flag, the Olympic athletes of Russia, because of the doping scandal that's been plaguing Russian athletics. And now one of these Winter Games athletes is facing a doping charge. And this is a curling athlete?
Yeah, so this is one of the Russian curlers who won bronze. It was Alexander Krushnetsky. He has failed at least one of the 2 drug tests that they're required to take. And because of that, there's, you know, once again, a cloud over these Olympics about Russia. And, you know, here you go again. And lots of questions are being asked about it, and certainly frustration from the IOC side as well.
Hmm. NPR's Russell Lewis speaking to us from Pyeongchang, South Korea. Russell, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
Well, the U.S. Army has 7 competitors in the Winter Olympics. They're part of a long tradition of soldiers whose other job is as an athlete. Krista Almanzon of member station KAZU has the story of Army bobsledder Nick Cunningham.
Nick Cunningham works through some drills around the track at a junior college just blocks from the beach.
So I'll just be jogging around, kind of get the blood flowing, making sure I don't tighten up. I'll have to do a lift later.
When visiting his hometown of Monterey on California's central coast, he has to be creative to stay on top of his training for the U.S. bobsled team. That kind of thinking works for Cunningham. It's why he tried out for the team in the first place after graduating from Boise State.
I figured it'd be a graduation gift to myself to kind of do something outside the box, outside my comfort zone, just try something none of my friends could ever say that they tried out for. And so I went and I tried out, and 18 months later, went to my first Olympics.
That first Olympics was 2010, where he competed in the 2- and 4-man bobsled events. After that, Cunningham did another thing completely out of the box.
Less than 2 months later, I'm putting my little thumbprint on the thing and I'm joining the military.
Cunningham became a member of the New York National Guard. He's now a sergeant. He did it to become part of the Army's world-class athlete program. It's an elite group of soldiers who have these orders.
They told me, go win medals for this country. And that's my job at this moment.
The Army World Class Athlete Program, or WCAP, is for soldier athletes who already have the proven ability to compete at this high level in an Olympic or Paralympic sport. They do basic training and advanced individual training like every other soldier. After that, winter athletes go to Lake Placid, New York, and the summer athletes to Fort Carson, Colorado. That's where I reach Colonel Sean Ryan by phone. He is Director of Communications for WCAP and a coach.
I think the biggest thing about the program is that it affords you the time. But with that time comes responsibility to maintain your proficiency in that sport and be eligible to make an Olympic or international team. If you don't do that, you get released from the program.
Soldier athletes began competing in the Olympics after World War II. The first athletes were boxers. Now, they compete in all sorts of events, from track and field to taekwondo. Since 1948, soldier athletes have won 118 medals in the Olympic and Paralympic Games.
That's what we're looking for. When they raise the flag and play the national anthem, we want it to be the United States anthem, and we want our soldier with their hand over the heart, with our flag being raised. That's the mark of success.
The program is paid for by a mix of government funds, fundraising, and corporate sponsorships. This Winter Olympics, the Army sent 7 soldier athletes, 4 competing in bobsled and 3 in luge.
Because we want to show that we're more than warfighters. These soldier athletes are incredible, so I think it just goes to show you how well-rounded the U.S. Army is.
For California bobsledder Nick Cunningham, the program makes being an Olympian possible.
Without the world-class athlete program, I would not be bobsledding still. I would have been out of the sport easily 4 years ago because of just the financial commitments that it takes. So to be able to have them as a kind of a backing and, you know, their support for me and everything that the Army brings, it has been phenomenal.
This is Cunningham's third Olympics. He's a driver in the 2- and 4-man bobsled events. After that, he's not sure what's next. Another Olympics, a career in the military, or something else out of the box. For NPR News, I'm Cristal Manzon in Monterey, California.
Well, on to cross country. There are 20 Americans competing in cross country at these Olympics. Half of them are from Alaska. This weekend, they tried to win the first ever cross-country Olympic medal for the United States. Alaska Public Media's Emily Russell reports.
To watch the American women race the 4x5-kilometer relay at the Olympics, I go to the home of a superfan. Holly Brooks comes to the door with her 5-month-old in a red and white striped onesie.
Look very festive.
Yeah. Hey.
Brooks was on the U.S. cross-country ski team at the 2010 and 2014 Olympics, and now she's a counselor for athletes. So what do you do when your team could make history, but the race is after midnight and you've got a set of 5-month-old twins? You host a slumber party.
Oh my gosh, you guys have great outfits on.
The girls lift up their winter coats, revealing t-shirts sporting the stars and stripes.
Oh, how cool! And you have relay socks on.
At the last Olympics and at World Cup races in Europe, the American women wore flashy red and white striped socks. Brooks has worn them in a few relays herself.
You know, it's almost like you put the socks on and you're transformed into this, like, this super powerful USA relay racer.
The American women's relay team finished fourth at the last three world championships. So people here really believe tonight is the night. They pile onto the couch. The NBC camera pans across the crowd. Fans wave little American flags in the air, and one guy with a U.S. ski team hat dances in the crowd.
Oh my God, who is that guy?
In Pyeongchang, the skiers jog out to the start line and snap into their skis.
I have goosebumps, guys.
Oh, yeah. Let us have the skis tonight.
I know.
Yeah. Sophie.
American Sophie Caldwell is first in the relay. She punches her poles into the snow, bounding forward. There are 14 teams in the relay, and pretty quickly a pack of seven skiers pulls ahead. The camera shows Caldwell in that pack, but with every turn, she falls farther behind.
Come on, Soph. Come on, Soph.
Oh, my God.
Come on.
The camera stays on the lead pack, and finally we can't see Caldwell at all. The leaderboard shows the gap when Caldwell hands off to the second leg of the relay. Brooks's husband, Rob Whitney, shakes his head.
We're over a minute out.
And these relays, they're usually won by seconds. In the end, it's Norway that wins gold. Sweden crosses the finish line just 2 seconds back, and an Olympic athlete from Russia earns bronze. Brooks leans up against her husband. I ask her how she's feeling.
Sorry, it's hard to say, but it's pretty disappointing. A little bit too reminiscent of Sochi, really, in a way.
The same thing happened. The first American leg of the relay fell behind by more than a minute. The team got eighth place at the Sochi Games.
I mean, I definitely still have hope.
Finally, American skier Jessie Diggins crosses the finish line. The camera shows her being held up and hugged by her three teammates. These women, they're smiling. The U.S. women's cross-country ski team did not win their first medal, but they climbed back up the leaderboard, and they finished fifth, which is their best relay result ever at the Olympics. For Here and Now, I'm Emily Russell in Anchorage, Alaska.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. A new year has begun, and if you are setting new goals for your business, you need the right people on your team. And ZipRecruiter has transformed how you find them. ZipRecruiter posts your job to over 100 job boards with just one click, then actively looks for the most qualified candidates and invites them to apply. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. ZipRecruiter. The smartest way to hire. Right now, listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/here.
What would happen if there was no cash, if it were all just digital and out there in the cloud somewhere? So that means no dollar bills, no coins you can hold in your hand. Well, Apple CEO Tim Cook said back in 2016 that Apple Pay would kill cash. So we wanted to see what a cashless society might look like. And if we do that, we'll turn to Sweden, because a recent survey found that only 25% of Swedes paid in cash once a week in 2017. That's down from over 60% a few years earlier. Robin Farzad hosts Full Disclosure on NPR One, and he joins us now with more. Hi there, Robin.
Magna, how are you?
I'm doing well, though I'm going to say it out here at the beginning. I think the reports of cash's demise are greatly premature. But let's look at what happened in Sweden. The survey was done by Insight Intelligence, and at some restaurants and stores in Sweden, there's even no cash accepted signs. So what's going on?
The Swedes are just always ahead of us. Why do they got to rub it in like that? Look, I do believe cash is ultimately going the way of the milkman or the floppy disk, because the friction and carrying costs of bills and coins just weigh down commerce. You have theft, counterfeiting, people waiting in line as some guy counts pennies, and then you have to pay an armed guard to haul it off while three guys with weapons wait in the truck. So, if you can kind of avoid all that or curtail it, it would ultimately recourse to the benefit of the business.
Okay, but what about all those folks who are unbanked, for example, or, maybe they don't want all of their transactions to be tracked? I think there's a lot of people who won't let go of those dollar bills or whatever the Swedes' currency is.
No doubt about it. And that's why you are seeing the United States as a much more unwieldy example. People, especially in the lower middle income groups, are in no rush to kind of, put everything on credit, especially if you carry a balance, especially if it's not as intuitive for you to to use Apple Pay or to use a debit card. Cash is still accepted virtually everywhere in the United States, maybe with the exception of some of those shishi airport lounges with the iPads, you know, where I think it's more because they don't want to hire people. They don't want to deal with humanity. And so that's a whole other episode.
Right. Now, about banks, though, is this true that several banks in Sweden are no longer offering cash deposits?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, look, inputting numbers and decimals and doing wire, you know, it's just the wire transfers are infinitely preferable to counting bills and checking big, you know, 50s and 100s for the watermarks. And then you have to think about security costs and everything in it. Increasingly, banks are trying to at least incent people to even step away from the bank branch and do these things online. And obviously, when it's done online, it's cashless.
Yeah. Now, we mentioned Apple CEO Tim Cook, who, of course, proclaimed that Apple Pay was going to kill cash. Ostensibly, I guess, because he wanted Apple Pay to be the default way that we pay for everything. That obviously hasn't happened because just last week he told shareholders that things were going more slowly, maybe for all the reasons that, you know, here in the United States that you were talking about before. But Robin, I got to say, I don't know, Western Union was supposed to kill cash, checks were supposed to kill cash, credit cards were supposed to kill cash, and yet here we still are.
Yeah, but you know what? You look at younger people and increasingly they're walking around with their iPhones or their other smartphones with these card holders on the back. They're trying to cut the cord with the wallet and the purse, and it's happening. It's about merchants and merchants accepting Apple Pay and Google Pay, and that is bound to happen over time. In the meantime, I say, Meghna, shed a tear for the pickpockets out there.
Robin Farzad hosts Full Disclosure on NPR One. Robin, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
It wasn't long ago that the sounds we heard on the air, through speakers or through headphones, were recorded, edited, and played on magnetic tape, reel to reel. Tape became the mainstay for the soundtracks of the 20th and early 21st century, but sound recording has totally changed, so much so that these days tape seems to have been all but abandoned. Or so one would think. Ilana Gordon from The Pulse at WHYY brings us this story.
It was around 2006, and Danny Miller was in a panic.
Ampex, which was the main tape manufacturer, stopped making tape.
No tape being manufactured meant no recording or editing in the way he and his team had relied on for decades. It was at the core of the production magic behind a radio show you might have heard of.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Danny is the longtime executive producer of Fresh Air here at WHYY. And for years, the national show used reels of tape to record, edit, and playback shows. They'd mastered a system, part science, part craft.
It's a little dusty, astuter.
Yeah.
Danny shows me an old reel-to-reel machine hiding in the corner of their studio. Imagine a really big cassette tape, flat on a table with two big spools.
Yeah.
Audrey Bentham, Fresh Air's chief engineer, cues up an old reel.
Just the sounds the machine makes and the sounds of the pinch roller hitting the sound. It's just like the sounds of production for the past 20 years. Just relics of what it used to be like.
We only have about a minute left and then our time is going to be up because they need the
Danny says editing an interview recorded on tape, meaning taking out part of the conversation or smoothing out a mistake, was all about using your ears to mark the changes and guide your hands.
You would basically listen, and when you got to an edit point, you would take a little wax marker, make a little white mark.
Then you'd literally cut or splice the tape with a razor blade at a 45-degree angle, take out what you didn't want, and glue it back together. That may seem really cumbersome these days, but reel-to-reel completely transformed how audio was produced.
It opened up all kinds of possibilities for editing.
Susan Schmidt-Horning is a professor at St. John's University and author of Chasing Sound. She says the concept of tape dates back to the late 1800s. But magnetic tape and the reel-to-reel process as we know it really took off after World War II.
It was based on a German recorder, the Nennophone, which was used by Hitler.
Towards the end of the war, U.S. servicemen brought it home. And then, Susan says, this guy caught wind of it.
The Bing Crosby Show.
Bing Crosby wanted an easier way to record and edit his radio show. He got excited about the technological possibilities of this new machine. So he fronted the money for a manufacturer, Ampex, to make one. And with that, the reel-to-reel tape recorder of the 20th century was basically born.
And then he'd roll, roll, roll. Way up the river, he would roll, roll, roll.
By the 60s, machines could record multiple tape tracks of separate voices or instruments. The sound quality got better and moved into stereo. But then, you probably know where this is going.
Digital recording replaced tape for many people.
Enter the digital age, totally revolutionizing the industry. No tapes needed, just computer software.
Well, digital came in a couple of different ways.
Jim Anderson is an audio engineer who went through the transition. He teaches at NYU. He's recorded and mixed classical, rock, and jazz artists, and some NPR shows. Jim says the shift to digital began as people got frustrated with some of the limitations of tape, like the distortion sounds from the recording and playback process. Digital didn't really have this issue.
It was a different sound, I think, is what people responded to. The bass would have been clearer, and maybe the top end had a little more transient to it.
Early digital programs surfaced in the late 1970s. The reliability and quality of digital improved over the following decades.
It went from being a toy to being ubiquitous.
Digital had a lot of advantages. You could add more tracks for recording, and editing was a whole new world. It's like a Word document for audio. You can so easily undo and redo, and you could easily edit and shape sounds that would be super complicated, if not impossible, with a razor blade.
Especially in our orchestral work, we can do things that we could never do, especially in recording and the dynamic range that we have available to us.
And digital didn't just make recording easier. It made it more portable. Like this summer, Jim got a call to record Gonzalo Rubalcaba, a jazz pianist. A few weeks later, he was making a major recording.
We went to Cuba and did a recording there in August. And we took with us a laptop, a front end, and some microphones. And, and it all sat on the size of a card table. And if we had done that in the past, like the guys from Mercury Living Presence in the 50s, they flew a truck to Russia to make stereo recordings and mono recordings, two-channel. We did a high-resolution 12-channel recording. So it's just crazy, you know.
Digital has also democratized the process. People can produce sonic wonders in their basement. But if you think tape has been totally abandoned, think again. Reel-to-reel still holds a special place among audio nerds and studio producers.
The War on Drugs, Lost in the Dream record was recorded a lot here at this studio. A lot of that process would be, recording to this 2-inch tape machine.
Brian McTeer is a record producer and owns Minor Street Recordings in Philadelphia, where he's worked on albums for the likes of War on Drugs, Kurt Weill, Hopalong, and Joan Osborne. He stands over his Ampex tape machine, and yes, he records on it all the time.
Recording studios still use tape. They do. And for a lot of reasons. Let me show you the tape machine. Let me show you this.
Brian's tape machine is like 300 pounds. It's the size of an industrial washer, and it can record up to 24 tracks. For him, the power of this machine is far more than the type of sound that it records. Recording on tape enforces a musical process. Band members must play together, recording all at once, instead of editing and manipulating sound so perfectly that they're perfectly boring. McTeer says a song, especially in rock and roll, is not just the sum of its parts. The music comes in the way it's played together.
Tape sort of reinforces the necessity of something we're all very used to, and something that's very sort of central to what music is, and that is ensemble performance.
Now, Brian also uses digital for editing and recording a lot, but he starts bands off on tape. He uses tape machines for something else too, creating a specific sound.
Do you think that in 5 years,
you'll still be using this thing, or maybe you'll make the switch over to digital?
So I will definitely be using this tape machine for the rest of my life. And if nobody wants it after I'm dead, they should bury me with it.
That's your ender.
That's your ender.
Back inside the Fresh Air studio, Audrey Bentham, the show's chief engineer, fast forwards to the end of the tape reel till it hits the edges as it circles around and around.
It's a classic sound of a tape machine spooling off.
Fresh Air's use of tape spooled off in 2007. Again, executive producer Danny Miller.
We were actually pretty late to digital editing.
Even so, Danny says the language of reel-to-reel is still everywhere in the vocabulary and mindset of the show.
We still refer to everything we do digitally as tape. We talk about, did you get good tape? That was really boring tape.
But once they switched over to digital, they haven't looked back.
Digital is just so much more convenient.
I mean, it's just so easy.
Do you miss cutting tape?
I kind of miss the showing off of the craft. But no, I don't miss cutting tape.
For Here and Now, I'm Alana Gordon.
At a Senate intelligence hearing last week on worldwide threats, intelligence agencies outlined their concerns over Russia's meddling in U.S. elections. But they also talked about China and how China's projecting soft power through colleges and universities in the United States. Republican Senator Marco Rubio from Florida pointed to Confucius Institutes.
I wrote a letter to five higher education institutions in Florida about the Confucius Institutes, which are funded by Chinese government dollars at U.S. schools. And it is my view that they're complicit in these efforts to covertly influence public opinion and to teach half-truths designed to present Chinese history, government, or official policy in the most favorable light.
Well, Elizabeth Redden, a correspondent with Inside Higher Ed, has been taking a look at renewed scrutiny over these Confucius Institute, and she joins us now via Skype. And Elizabeth, there are about 100 or so of these institutes at U.S. schools, and they teach Chinese language and culture. So what's the concern?
So there's been a number of concerns over the years about academic freedom, essentially, and the universities basically outsourcing curricular control to an entity associated with the Chinese government. But what was new at last week's hearing was that the FBI director, Christopher Wray, suggested that the FBI has been monitoring these institutes with some level of concern. Senator Rubio was asking specifically about the sort of counterintelligence risk posed and the potential of intellectual property theft. He was asking that more broadly about China, but that was sort of another angle of what came up in last week's hearing.
So if the FBI is monitoring these Confucius Institutes, are they saying that they're concerned with some potential criminal activity going on?
Yeah, Christopher Wray didn't go quite as far as saying that, but the FBI director essentially said that they've been watching the institutes, as he used the word, watching them warily, and in certain instances have developed appropriate investigative steps. So that was as far as we got in terms of detail, but certainly it did suggest that Confucius Institutes have been at least a subject of investigative attention by the FBI, okay, if nothing else.
So back to the sort of academic concern here, which I actually have to say in this day and age is more than just an academic one, right? Because the other issue that Senator Rubio raised was that, you know, he was concerned that because the Chinese government is funding and staffing these Confucius Institutes, that they're seeking to influence sort of academic papers, research, teaching and learning over Chinese history and present policy. So essentially just sort of like controlling what maybe American students learn and think about what's going on in China.
Exactly. I mean, I think there's been, and you know, this has been the issue of soft power and countries trying to put forward a positive view of themselves and cultivate positive perceptions. It's not new. I mean, the U.S. has done similar things. But I think there has been sort of increasing concern about China in its push for soft power and in its push for influence, also exporting, for example, its censorship regime overseas. We've seen some examples, for example, of scholarly journals that have blocked access to certain content in China in order to continue having access to the China market. So there is concern, you know, when does soft power morph into something harder than soft power, I suppose.
Right. And so, I mean, to your point about this isn't necessarily something new, I mean, I'm thinking that many other governments have done exactly this. You pointed to the United States projecting power this way abroad. But here inside this country, I mean, the Saudi government, for example, for years has spent hundreds of millions of dollars on similar institutes, funding professorships, you know, buying entire buildings for colleges. And there has been concern there that the Saudis are trying to, you know, sort of shape what Americans learn and think about Wahhabism or politics in the Middle East. So it isn't, it really isn't anything new. And to that point, though, like, should we be thinking more about where this money and funding for all these kinds of institutes are coming from on American campuses?
I do think the issue should be looked at closely beyond the issue of China. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. And the issue is, are there strings attached to this money? And to what degree do entities that are accepting this money still maintain control and autonomy?
Now, in your reporting, have you spoken to people who support these Confucius Institutes? And what's their argument?
Yeah, a lot of people do. And, you know, essentially the argument is that this is just a form of academic cooperation. You know, the Chinese government is providing U.S. colleges and universities and U.S. K-12 schools, for that matter, with money to teach Chinese, which frankly, there's fewer and fewer resources available domestically for that.
Right. But, you know, to your point about sort of the concerns about universities not having control over what goes on at these institutes, I mean, as you've reported back in 2014, the American Association of University Professors called on academia, essentially in the United States, to end their involvement with Confucius Institutes unless the university has unilateral control over what's going on. I mean, Marco Rubio, as we heard earlier, is calling on five higher ed institutions in Florida to end their ties with these institutes. How many of them have closed in the United States?
So actually, in response to Senator Rubio's letter, one of the five institutions, University of West Florida, responded by saying that they had already decided to close their institute when the contract expires later this spring. There's been a few others that have closed, a couple high-profile cases. The most high-profile was University of Chicago, which closed theirs following the circulation of a faculty petition. Penn State also closed their institute as well several years ago.
Interesting. Well, Elizabeth Redden is a correspondent with Inside Higher Ed. Elizabeth, thank you so very much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Jeremy Hobson is back tomorrow. This is Here and Now.